Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. Get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.
From KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, and today on this special edition of The Breakdown, a nation on edge. As we prepare for a transfer of power, we hope it's going to be peaceful. We think it will. We're going to dig into the security situation in the wake of the violent January 6th attack on the nation's capital and look ahead to the coming days.
Things were thankfully calm over the weekend despite threats of demonstrations by far-right groups, but authorities are still on high alert in D.C. and across the country. We're going to talk about all that and what's ahead for the GOP and the country once Trump leaves office.
And I must say, we have an all-star group here to chew this all over. It is dinner time after all, so we're going to do some chewing. First up, Katie Orr, our Sacramento reporter. And Katie, you were out and about and in Sacramento, across the street from the Capitol yesterday. Of course, there was a lot of security up, but sort of tell us what you were looking for and what actually happened. What was the mood there?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if I would get to the Bureau and see mobs of, people protesting the inauguration, people supporting Trump, people supporting Biden, Harris, things like that. Instead, I got there and there was literally, I did not see a protester until like maybe later that afternoon. There was a handful. I mean, I could count on like two hands the number of protesters I saw. What I did see immediately upon getting into downtown was just the heavy presence of the National Guard. They were stationed in front of several state office buildings. Most notably, they weren't just standing there. They were in their full like combat uniforms, armed, machine guns out, tanks parked in the street, or I don't know if they're tank military vehicles parked in the streets. Huge presence of CHP officers. There was a 6-foot fence around the Capitol and then a fence inside of that. So it was just a very surreal scene. But again, no protesters.
Well, right. But I mean, and that does compare to, I mean, you've covered some pretty violent protest in Sacramento before. We did see some folks out on January 6th, the same day the Capitol was mobbed. I mean, do you feel like this was a response, the lack of protesters was a result of this heavy security situation?
Yeah, I mean, well, I do think that it was the Capitol's way of preparing for what very possibly could have happened. As you mentioned, there have been protests in Sacramento for months, protests in support of Black Lives Matter, which were overwhelmingly peaceful, and moved through the streets, but there was still a heavy police presence. We have seen groups like the Proud Boys demonstrating at the Capitol and getting into fights with people from Antifa groups that have, and it has turned violent before. So it's not like the law enforcement was preparing for no reason, but it's almost as if these groups that would have turned out sort of knew that they were expected and kind of didn't come because they knew that they were expected.
Yeah, big relief overall for sure. What are you hearing, if anything, from legislators, from the governor's office in terms of, do they feel like now the crisis has passed, or do they really just need to keep their guard up and they're just relieved that nothing has happened so far?
I mean, I think the guard is certainly going to be kept up at least through Wednesday, the inauguration. We still have been hearing warnings that yes, these protests might not have happened on Sunday, but there is still potential for them to happen. I personally feel like perhaps they might not be as massive as we were thinking, given that there doesn't seem to be a ton of momentum for them right now. But again, you never know what people are planning. And I know that lawmakers have expressed some concern about these protesters. There was last week, several women stood up in a Senate budget hearing committee and started, you know, yelling about buying guns and yelling that their displeasure with the lawmakers, essentially. So I think there are people that are nervous, but that is, again, why we're seeing such a huge law enforcement presence around the Capitol.
Yeah, and I think something we're going to get into with our other guest is like, just, I mean, I think we're all preparing to get through the inauguration, but these groups aren't going to go away come Wednesday, right? I mean, this is a longstanding problem. Switching gears before we let you go, Katie, Kamala Harris did resign her Senate seat today. She is obviously going to be sworn in as vice president. We have Alex Padilla, the first Latino senator from California, who will be sworn in the next day or two. Obviously, Javier Becerra, our general, also got appointed to be the head of Health and Human Services in D.C. So any thoughts on who might replace him? Any scuttlebutt on the Padilla change? Like, what are you hearing up there about these musical chairs as it is?
I know. I mean, and I think it's important to note that Attorney General has been historically like a launching pad for politicians in California. Of course, Kamala Harris, Jerry Brown was Attorney General. Not that he needed a launching pad, but I'm just saying it's a very high profile position for people. It'll be interesting to see if the same kind of issues that sort of plagued Newsom during the Senate appointment kind of haunt him during the AG appointment. And that being,
he was self-inflicted.
Right. He waited a long time. And, you know, but he was feeling a lot of pressure from certain different, like, different groups to appoint, like, say, a Black woman or a Latino man, or, you know, perhaps, you know, Daryl Steinberg's name has been mentioned. He was the former Senate leader and now the mayor of Sacramento as a possible AG. He is a white man. Does that, you know, hurt him in this race? I know Lorena Gonzalez, who an assemblywoman who had wanted to be Secretary of State, and now she did not get that appointment. You know, is she someone that's going to be in the mix? Probably not, because she's got a very tenuous relationship with tech companies. But there are a lot of people who would like that position, and you can be sure that they are lobbying the governor right now to try and get it
as we speak. All right, Katie Orr, KQED Sacramento reporter, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Katie.
Stay safe out there. All right, we are going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll continue our conversation, or start our conversation, actually, with USA Today national correspondent Will Carlis and Republican strategist Tim Miller. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as, like, the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest, and I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts, because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer, and we are talking about the ongoing threats of violence in America, as well as what's next for the nation, just 2 days from Joe Biden's inauguration as the 46th president of the United States. Joining us now is Will Carlis. He's a national correspondent for USA Today, where he covers extremism. Will, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
And Republican strategist and writer for The Bulwark, Tim Miller. Tim, thanks for being here.
Hey, good to be with you.
So, Will, I want to start with you. As we mentioned, you cover extremism in America. You have been, you were in D.C. on January 6th. You flew back out there this weekend. And we really saw what you predicted to me last week. I think you said this would be a big nothing burger. Why do you think that is? And what potential threats still lie ahead this week, not just in D.C., but across the nation?
Well, I think it's, I mean, it's been pretty widely reported, but I mean, when you have, you know, 20,000, 30,000 troops in the nation's capital, you have an 8-foot high steel fence surrounding basically the whole center of power. You have, you know, all of these National Guard troops everywhere. I mean, the signs are pretty strong to any wannabe troublemakers. Look, this isn't the time or the place to come and do it. In addition, I mean, I did a story a few days ago about how the leaders of extremist groups have actually been calling on their followers not to appear at any protests, either for the 17th or for the inauguration on Wednesday, for various reasons. I mean, they argue that it's a trap. They argue that the FBI is trying to sort of draw people in and then arrest them all. But also, I think that there's an acknowledgement from a certain wing of the extremist far right that, look, the battle's over. At least this part of the battle's over. And, you know, it's time to sort of go back and regroup and come back at some other point.
You tweeted, Will, about a bit of a little conversation or some conversation that was happening between some of the Black Lives Matter activists in Virginia today with some of the far right extremists. What can you tell us about that? And what was the tone of the conversation?
Yeah, you're right on the money. And this is something that's been going through my brain for the last few hours. Is, you know, I'm starting to see these kind of conciliatory moves by some of these opposing groups. At the moment, it's mainly just sort of not very powerful people. But I mean, it was interesting. I was at this pro-gun rally in Richmond, Virginia this morning and this afternoon. And yeah, you did have these people who purported to be supporters of Black Lives Matter, you know, shaking hands with, joking around with, bonding with members of the Proud Boys. Now, these are groups that last month were literally fighting in the streets. The leader of the Proud Boys has told me many times he considers Black Lives Matter to be a terrorist organization. He sort of infamously burned down a Black Lives Matter banner, which he's now facing charges for. So it's interesting to see those two groups maybe start to, perhaps in the wake of January 6th and the extraordinary events, maybe start to try and find some common ground. It may also be that they're trying to strike a conciliatory tone so that the federal government and federal law enforcement don't go after them and slap them all with federal charges in the wake of January 6th. So I'm a bit of a skeptic. I wouldn't say someone did a wonderful tweet that said Virginia is for lovers, and sort of mentioning that. And I'm not going to go quite that far just yet. But there are some rumblings.
So, Will, and I want to turn to Tim on some of this, too. But I mean, we've seen in the last few days a real crackdown that just didn't happen before on Trump and his followers on social media, just really limiting their ability. I don't want to frame this as to talk to the public, because Trump is still the president. He could still just go on TV or hold a briefing. Right. But there's this direct connection. And I'm just curious if you see that crackdown as part of why things have been relatively calm in the last few days after what happened earlier this month. Obviously, you've already detailed the security presence, but is that part of it, too? Is it just harder to organize?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. I mean, it's taken the oxygen out of the fire. I mean, when Trump isn't there to rile up his supporters. Now, I want to be very careful. I mean, it has taken the oxygen out of the fire. Now, we're still, you know, 48 hours from inauguration. And look, President Trump could put out a statement, could go on Fox News, could say something inflammatory that could, in theory, result in millions of these people kind of causing some sort of a ruckus, even descending on Washington, D.C., even given the security that's here. So I want to be very clear on that. But certainly not just the deplatforming of President Trump from Twitter, which was absolutely huge, but also the kind of falling apart, the deplatforming of Parler, the social media app that a lot of these people were using. You know, that it's not so much that these people are no longer communicating. They're still getting in touch with each other, but they no longer have this very public facing platform where they can sort of all say, we're in this together. We're all going to come to these events together, where they can put up flyers and say, let's all be there at a certain date at a certain time. And that really does, you know, hamper their organizational efforts. And I think that it's the other half of the coin to the security measures that have been taking place in D.C.
Tim Miller, I'm wondering what you think. Obviously, this massive military presence in the nation's capital as well as in state capitals has, you know, certainly hit the pause button for a lot of these groups. But what are you hearing from Republicans, people who are thinking about this? Is there, you know, might there be like a sort of detente, if that's not the right word, but I mean, a way in which this might get walked back a little bit now that we've come right to the brink?
Boy, I have a gloomier outlook than Will on the state of affairs. I think
Virginia is not for lovers.
Yeah, no, part of that's probably because I think Will is probably right and totally deferred his expertise when it comes to these kind of organized extremist militant groups. When you looked at the rally on the 6th, what you saw was, I think, a mix, right, of those organized extremist groups and kind of a weird conflagration of just MAGA, QAnon superfans, right? Some of them who I think were very, you know, kind of serious about the effort to the insurrection. Some of them along for the ride, along for the Instagram content. You know, I think that's why you saw this kind of weird dichotomy in the initial pictures that came out of the rally. So I worry about the group. There is this other group of MAGA superfans that really think he still might be president next Thursday. Mm-hmm. I know this is hard to believe, but if you look at, I wrote up for the Bulwark, I guess the other day, about what Mike Lindell, who's the MyPillow CEO, who's been pushing these Stop the Steal rallies, and he gave this interview on Right Side Broadcasting News, which, you know, is getting a million views on right. YouTube, where he's saying that Trump still might be president on Thursday. This is still kind of out there in certain parts of the MAGA media and social media universe. It has been cracked down on, as you mentioned, Marisa, but, you know, since the platforms had some action. So I worry about one-off folks who get disappointed and radicalized on Wednesday. And then when you look at the House and the Senate, I just look to what Rand Paul had to say. You know, Rand Paul said that if they convict President Trump, 33% of the party goes away immediately. They lose a third of their voters immediately. And I think that was a very correct and revealing point of view. I think it's why only 10 people did the right thing in the House in voting to impeach him. And I think that, while there'll be a small part of the Republican D.C. establishment that wants to work with Joe Biden, I think the vast majority of them will go into oppositional mode, grievance mode, pretty quickly following the inauguration.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. Today we're talking to USA Today's Will Carlos and Republican strategist and Bulwark writer Tim Miller. Tim, I want to stick with you for a second on this. I mean, you've called really forcefully for people to be held account for what happened on January 6th and leading up to it. What does that look like, not just legally, but politically? I mean, given what you're spelling out, I mean, we've seen other polls that show, you know, a broad majority of Republicans still think Trump should be president. And I mean, just such a gap between what people who are not Trump supporters feel and, you know, and how they view what happened on January 6th and the rest of us.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to hold accountable. I guess the positive elements, I think, on the accountability side of things is if you look at the Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley numbers right now, they are extremely unpopular. You know, Trumpism does not really transfer. to, you know, some of these more traditional Republican types. You know, Josh Hawley's kind of model UN white power fist, you know, thing just doesn't land with the MAGA nationalists the same way that that Trump stuff does. So I think that you know, when you look at some of the things the Lincoln Project is doing, holding them accountable on the financial side of things, I think that Hawley's in for a tough little period. On the other side, there's a group called the Republican Accountability Project that is going to be supporting the 10 people that voted to impeach in primaries. Just frankly, this is a fight within the party that's worth having. I am totally clear-eyed about the fact that the Republican base very much wants Trumpism and is very sympathetic to the president in spite of his absolutely unconscionable actions in the lead up to the 6th. But I think that in certain districts, in certain states, there are ways to create pain for the people that go along with it. And the prime example of that is in Georgia. You know, look, it's tough to hold that coalition together if there's an internal fight. And Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue made a bet to go all in with Trump on the coup. And, you know, they turned off enough voters in the suburbs, and there were enough, you know, of the QAnon voters that bought the, you know, fake voting machine thing to allow the Democrats to win two races. I mean, that was accountability right there. And I think that there will be other examples of that.
Will, you've been reporting on these extremist groups for such a long time. And I'm just wondering, do you feel like, have they grown under Trump, or have they just sort of come out of the woodwork through social media and now most recently at the Capitol and even in Michigan, you know, with that attempt to possibly kidnap the governor of Michigan? You know, what's your take on the dynamics of these groups?
That's a good question. And I think it needs to be answered in terms of not defining these groups as a sort of a monolithic entity. They are, you know, as your other guest pointed out, you know, this is a wild, bizarre party of different beliefs and people who believe different things. So if we break it down for a minute, I mean, groups like the QAnon group, for example, which is one significant strata of the people that we saw last week, certainly they've grown. I mean, that has grown as a conspiracy theory. It's grown as a political movement, so that it's now just sort of unavoidable. I mean, we see it everywhere, and there are millions of people who are devoted to that. But then you look at groups like, for example, the organized armed militia groups, who I'm personally most concerned about. We've seen them certainly getting more extreme, but really those groups tend to grow. The Second Amendment groups, the pro-gun people, tend to grow actually when there's a Democrat in the White House. And the reason for that is that they all get very excited and charged up about the possibility of gun control, and the fact that they get whipped into a frenzy about the idea that the Democratic president is going to take away their gun rights. And you see, traditionally, you've seen militias, you know, grow. They grew enormously when President Obama was elected. They've kind of stayed steady during Trump, but certainly they're going to be using Biden incoming as a recruitment tool. But then you also have this kind of just group, this massive group of kind of what I would sort of describe as almost like mom and pop MAGAs, which are just these Trump supporters that sort of believe in some of the conspiracies, and they believe that for example, the election was stolen, but they're not all in on any particular kind of extremist group. They're not part of a militia. They're not part of the Proud Boys. You know, they're just kind of very angry people. And the one of the big debates I think we need to have as a nation is like, do we call those people extremists? You know, mm-hmm. Do we call them part of that extremist movement? Because certainly they were there cheering on and backing the people who stormed the Capitol last Wednesday. But really, if you start to lump those people in, we're talking about tens of millions of people who believe these kind of bizarre theories. You know, is at what point does extremism become just, you know, a mainstream thing that a lot of people believe? It's a very strange time in our nation's history.
Yeah, and those are all voters. I mean, Tim, you've worked in Republican politics for a long time, helped run, you know, national campaigns. I mean, do you feel like this was, I don't know, a sleeping giant that was there all along and folks weren't aware of? I mean, to Will's point, we saw a lot of this really explode under Obama when it came to the far right groups. But your mom and pop folks. I mean, what's your sense?
Yeah, look, I think it's two things at once. I think that this was a sleeping giant that people weren't aware of and that was exacerbated by Trump and his unique unconscionable behavior and his unique pathologies and who he brought into the party. I mean, look, if you go back to the Tea Party, kind of fights of 2010, and if you look at those protests, and I was oftentimes on the more establishment side of primaries versus Tea Party candidates, the people that turned out for Tea Party candidates were very much, kind of middle class people. They're older voters, felt like they're losing the country. Some of these people were also there on January 6th. But I think that Trump brought in, a kind of younger, sort of white male, blue collar, not college educated, very angry about the way things are going with society, and very extreme in their political ideology, and so I think that this was already something that was on the cusp, and we saw signs of this, of course.
Tim, let me just jump in, Tim, for a second. Like, what happened to all the Republicans who were for lower taxes and free trade, and tough on Russia, tough on China?
Speak for them.
Where are they?
I don't know that we're Republicans anymore. I know Marisa keeps calling me a Republican strategist. I'm like cringing because
should I not? I mean, I don't know. I don't want to like undercut.
I mean, I guess technically, I don't know. I'm in a transitional period.
Have you left the party?
Okay. I for all intents and purposes, I have. I think that, as I said, I do think it'll be important to have folks that are defending the people that do the right thing right now with regards to Donald Trump, because I think that's important. And so, I'll be supportive of Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney and the people who are doing the right thing. But for all intents and purposes, I don't see myself as a Republican. And I think the reality is, Scott, I think that there's a small remnant of Republicans that fit what you describe, that are kind of a minority of the party now, that are completely swamped by the nationalist populist, base. And then I think there's another group of people like me, like folks that identified with the Lincoln Project, that are for practical purposes, in temporary alliance with the Democrats, because, maybe we still believe in low taxes still, maybe we still believe in being tough on Russia and smaller government, but on the fundamental issues of pluralism, of welcoming immigrants, of the rule of law, the Democrats are the only party that believes that is acting on these kind of fundamental American principles, and I think that a lot of us are aligning with the Democrats over that, and putting policy to the side. And to be honest with you, I think that is how our politics are going to look for the short to medium term. I don't see the Republican Party tacking back on this kind of anti-democratic, anti-rule of law, nationalist strain that was unleashed under Trump. I think that's going to continue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I promised at the top we would talk about the world post-inauguration. I'm curious, given what you talked about in terms of the increase of militias under Obama, given what we know about the fact that there's a lot of questions about people in law enforcement either sympathizing or being parts of these groups, what do you see as the kind of challenge for this new administration and for all government in the coming months and years?
Well, I think the biggest mistake would be to think that because these people haven't shown up or, don't show up this week, that they've gone away and that this ideology has suffered some sort of a setback. Look, these people, they're zealots and they're true believers, and there's an awful lot of them, and they believe that Trump is president. A lot of them, that you can add a religious aspect in there where they believe that, Trump is sort of, aligned with Christianity and aligned with God. And, those aren't people who are going to just kind of go away and stop doing this. So I think if I could predict what's going to happen, I think that there's going to be a sort of an interim period where you see a lot of these groups kind of go away and lick their wounds to a certain extent and kind of reassess, and then perhaps come back with a new front. I mean, I can see a situation in sort of, maybe April, maybe May, June, where somebody organizes another Charlottesville type event, and you see these groups really kind of come out of the woodwork again and say, look, we didn't go anywhere and make some sort of a show of force. I don't know what that means politically. And I do think, you know, something that's really overshadowed the whole of this conversation, and this may sound strange when we had a, you know, an insurrection in the nation's capital last week, but ultimately we're still talking about extremist groups. We're talking about fringe groups. And right. I want to try and remember that. You know,
that's not, it's not the majority. People. It is not the majority. Our World Colossus of USA Today, former Republican strategist and bulwark writer, Tim Miller, thank you
future.
Both so much for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. That will do it for this special edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. We will be back here at the same time tomorrow night on the eve of the inauguration for another special edition. We're going to talk about what's next for California's native daughter, Kamala Harris.
For tonight, our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Brendan Willard. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Erica Aguilar, and Jonathan Blakely. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at MLagos. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mindshift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.